This is an oral history interview with Mr. Fred Austin, taken as part of the Polar Oral History Project conducted by the American Polar Society and the Byrd Polar Archival Program of The Ohio State University on a grant provided by the National Science Foundation. The interview was conducted at Mr. Austin's home in Reno, Nevada by Brian Shoemaker on the 4th of September in the year 2000. Mr. Austin, about 25 years ago this November, you and Harrison French flew around the world via the poles. And you're the first to have ever done so. These things don't just happen. It takes a good deal of planning, fundraising, cajoling, leadership prior to takeoff. You just don't say one day I want to go. But you brought a lot of yourself to this, your background. You know, you're a very experienced pilot when you came, that was obvious, but there's more to it than that. So we'd like to start you off where you came from, where you hailed from, how you got into, where you were educated, and how you got into flying. And just carry it forward from there through the Polecat.
Well, I learned to fly at a little place called Trona, California, on the Mojave Desert, and in a single engine biplane. And my instructor got a job with Western Airlines in 1935, a year after I'd learned to fly. And we thought the job for him was just for the summer. So he turned his airplanes over to me, and I ran a fixed base operation for him, and continued to do that for several years as his job. He stayed on with Western. When I had about 1,200 hours of flying time, I got a job with Catalina Airlines, flying between Wilmington, California, and Catalina Island in twin-engine Douglas Dolphin amphibians. And I was there about 2 years, and then got a job as a co-pilot with TWA, and went to work in Kansas City, and flew as a co-pilot for 2 years, and got checked out as a captain.
Which year was that you first went to?
That was 1942, when I got checked out as a captain. I flew with TWA in all of their types of airplanes, starting out flying from Kansas City to New York, and then all of the TWA's routes. And in 1947, I went to the International Division and flew to Europe for 3 years, all through Europe.
What type of planes? Which type planes were those? Aircraft?
Those were on the International Division. They were DC-4s. Mm-hmm. I'd always flown DC-3s domestically, and then on that operation we started with DC-4s, and about a year after I was there, we got Lockheed Constellations. And so I flew the whole series of Lockheed Constellations for several years, 3 years to be exact, and then returned to the domestic operation in Los Angeles. And then I had several years of experience with TWA, and finally wound up as director of operations in New York. And from there, I wanted to go back to California So I became the chief pilot of TWA in Los Angeles in 1959, I believe it was. Yes, 1959. And remained in that job until I retired.
When did you retire?
And there I was flying Constellations and 707s.
Mm-hmm. And you flew as chief pilot for TWA out of LA for how long before you retired?
About 6 years. And
so you retired about 1967, 68?
I retired in 1967, right, yes.
Okay. We're back on.
All right.
So you retired from TWA in 1966, but the Polecat flight was shortly before that.
1967, yes.
67.
And
so, had you flown across the Arctic as TWA in the international?
No, no. Mostly that was to Europe. In 1943. I flew a flight up to the Aleutians and through Alaska and up to the Aleutians for TWA, but and spent one summer basically flying the Aleutian route, carrying
troops,
carrying servicemen out to the Aleutians and to Nome and places like that in Alaska.
That's while the fighting was going on with the Japanese there?
That's, yeah, right.
Okay. Did you see combat with or come under fire?
No. One of the first trips I made to the Aleutians, we landed at Umnak, which in those days was the last American base in the Aleutian Islands. And when we landed there, we were only on the ground a short time, and the commanding officer came to me and he said, "Captain," he said, "you'd better get fueled up and get out of here." He said, "We've just had three Japanese planes attack us, and we shot down three Japanese planes." And he said, "We have no idea where they are at the present time." And he said, "If I were you, I'd get back to the mainland as soon as you could." So.
That was
my wartime experience.
That was your Arctic experience, more
right,
or less.
Yeah.
So, well, it sounds like you had quite a career with TWA, and that's another subject, but it certainly gave you the background for long-distance flying.
Right.
And what made you think that you could fly? Had flights become routine by then across the Arctic?
Well, no. Leading, why we made the flight is really what you're saying.
Yes.
And I attended an Explorers Club meeting with Harrison Finch, my TWA associate. In 1964, I believe it was, and Lowell Thomas, who then was president of the Explorers Club, in his speech that night talked about the fact that all of the flights in the lower atmosphere had been done and there really were no more flights to be done in the lower atmosphere. And on thinking that over, I told Harrison, "Well, that really isn't true because no one has flown over both poles. And no one has flown around the world without refueling, so there's at least two more flights that need to be done." And from that, Harrison and I decided that we should investigate flying around the world over both poles. And from that, we started an investigation of what it would take to fly around the world over both poles. And we worked at that for about a year, really, practically full time, trying to line up money and trying to line up airplanes. Most of the airlines, all of the airlines were very negative about leasing us an airplane. And finally, we went to the Flying Tiger line, Bob Prescott, who then owned it, and talked to Bob about it, and he was willing to lease us a 707B, which was the latest model of the 707 at that time. And from there, once we had the airplane, then we started out to, or continued to attempt to get money raised. And Harrison knew John DuBois, who was a member of the Explorers Club, who lived in, I'll never forget, John DuBois lived in DuBois, Pennsylvania, and he owned the DuBois Iron Company in DuBois. So he suggested that we talk to Rockwell, Colonel Rockwell, who was the chairman of Rockwell Manufacturing Company, and see if he had an interest. So Harrison and I called Colonel Rockwell and his son Al, talked to his son Al, actually, and he was interested. His father's wife had just died, and they were trying to find something to interest his father, and he thought that perhaps a project like the Polar Flight might be of interest to him. So we worked with him, and he finally agreed to finance our flight. He eventually paid us $250,000 to do the flight. So from there, everything began to fit. We had the airplane, we had the money, and we decided to do it as a scientific exploration. And
what kind of science did you hope to do?
Well, we got together a group of scientists, a lot of them that we knew, like Serge Korf, who was a scientist in cosmic radiation at Columbia University. Mm-hmm. And we were quite interested in doing some clear air research on
Clear air research on the
to turbulence and clear air research. And we finally wound up doing about 27 different experiments that we carried on the flight. And one of them was the first inertial navigation system from the Litton Corporation. And that worked quite successfully. We did a lot of research on composition of the atmosphere, and found that there are great masses of air, pockets of air in the atmosphere. And we had the head at the time of the United States Weather Bureau, a man by the name of Captain Newt Lorenz of the Navy, went with us on the flight. I had known Newt at TWA. He'd been a meteorologist at TWA. And he did a lot of a lot of the research on the composition of the atmosphere. Serge Korff did a lot of, Dr. Korff did a lot of research on the cosmic radiation. And we had Lauren de Groot from the Weems Corporation, Weems Navigation Company, that did research on finding the location of navigation research on celestial navigation for use of the astronauts in outer space. But altogether, we did 27 different experiments.
So it was a scientific flight.
It was a scientific flight, right.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chief scientist that coordinated all this, or?
Yes. The chief scientist that coordinated was Dr. Serge Korff of Columbia.
And he also did cosmic ray research.
Yes, right.
Okay, so he was the chief scientist, and but you took some others. You took Rockwell. Now, this wasn't Alan Rockwell that came. It was the he was the son, right?
No, Al was the son, and he later became chairman of Rockwell International. But his father, Colonel John Rockwell, had asked if he could go on the flight from Los Angeles to Honolulu, and he thought it'd just be a nice flight for him to participate in. So when we got to Honolulu, he was enjoying his trip so much that he asked me if it'd be all right if he could go on around the world with us. So I was quite pleased with that, and of course said yes, and I fixed up one of the bunks just behind the cockpit so that he could be very comfortable, and he went with us all the way around the world. At that time he was about 72 years old, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. He was just 72 at the time. By the way, how old are you now?
I'm 85 now.
A young 85. Okay, so you got the money, you got the science program lined up, you've got the aircraft.
Right.
And did you do any test flying or anything beforehand?
No.
See what your fuel consumption would be or
no.
Anything like that?
It was pretty cut and dried. We had been flying 707s for couple of years by then, or more than that, and so we really didn't need to do anything like that. But
this was a pretty new aircraft, though.
Yes, it's a brand new aircraft. It's a brand new aircraft for the Flying Tigers out of Boeing. One of the things that we did have to do, we knew we had to extend the flying range.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend in Los Angeles named Joe Schertzinger, who was doing some work for the military in the construction of flexible fuel tanks. And he had set up a corporation in Pasadena to build portable fuel tanks for the military, and these were made of fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And tied down with straps.
Mm-hmm.
And
bladders.
Bladders. They were bladders, right?
Right.
Exactly. And so he made us a couple of tanks that carried a total of 4,000 gallons between the two. 4,000 gallons. And we installed those in the fuselage, main fuselage of the 707. And that work was done by the Flying Tigers and the Boeing Company.
And so this was somewhat experimental too.
That was very experimental, right.
Okay, tell me about the flight. Where'd you start?
I'm sorry.
The flight began in California, right?
Yes, there was an air, a big air show was taking place, and the day we were ready to leave, in Palm Springs, one of the first big air shows in California, and they wanted us to take off from there, so. We got our people together, and we should talk a little bit about the people that we carried on the flight.
I think that'd be good before we talk about the flight, huh?
Yeah.
Good idea.
We carried, as I recall, we had 27 people, 27 passengers on the airplane, either as observers or as participating in the very experiments that we did. And we carried a crew of five pilots.
Five pilots?
Five captains.
Five captains.
And
who were the other captains besides yourself and Harrison?
Well, Harrison and myself and the first person I asked to go was Captain Bob Buck of TWA, who was a very senior international pilot who had more time practically on the North Atlantic than any other pilot at that time. And I also asked Jim Gannett, who was a test pilot at Boeing and who had participated in all of the heavyweight test flights done by Boeing. And that was going to be our crew, but a few days before the flight, I was talking to Prescott, and he was quite unhappy that he figured he wasn't going to get as much publicity as he would like to have from the flight. So, in discussing it with him, I said, well, why don't you put a skeleton crew on of Flying Tiger pilots, and that will give you the publicity that you want. So, with that, he assigned a flight engineer and a navigator and a pilot.
Mm-hmm. Who were they?
A captain with
Well, they're in the report, right?
Yeah, they're in the report.
Okay.
Right. So that made up our flight crew.
So you had a crew of five captains, and then an engineer, and a navigator.
Three flight engineers, mm-hmm. Three navigators.
Okay.
Three navigators. And John Larson was the chief navigator who had been TWA's chief navigator when I was there. And when I was there. And John did all of the minute planning. Harrison Finch laid out the basic plan of the navigation, and then John put the finishing touches to it.
So Harrison said, here's where we'll go from here to here to here to here. And then John came along and figured out how long it'd take and headings and,
Harrison did an awful lot of that, but John did put the final touches to it.
So how did you decide on well, first of all, that's your flight crew. Total flight crew of five captains, three engineers, and three navigators.
11. And
so that's 11.
We had one man went along, as we called our communicator, Goody Lyons, who was also a pilot with TWA. And he acted as our
radioman.
No, putting we called him our communicator, but that wasn't a very good title for him.
Handle publicity?
Getting the clearances.
Clearances were
required for the flight. He did a lot of that work.
So, you all met in Burbank?
We met in Burbank and took off from Burbank and went to Palm Springs. And after a short stop there, we went to Honolulu, which is actually the beginning point of the flight. Mm-hmm. We wanted to stay as close as possible to the zero and 180 degree meridian. And we were in Honolulu about 2 hours, fueled up, and went directly over the North Pole. We flew most of the whole flight. We flew at 37,000 feet. We wanted to do to get a narrow strip of a space on the whole flight at the same altitude for scientific purposes. So we flew the whole flight at 37,000 feet. And we went over the North Pole and down to London. And we had planned to land at a military field outside of London. But as we were on our approach to London, the field socked and closed in. And we were forced to go into Heathrow for fuel. And then we found that the runway was such at Heathrow that it was restricted and we would have to land and make another landing. We had planned to go from London to Buenos Aires direct, mm-hmm. but we couldn't get enough fuel because of the distances of the runway, restricted runway. So we decided to go to Lisbon and fuel up at Lisbon, which we did. And then we went from Lisbon to Buenos Aires, fueled up, and we were only there about 2 hours. And went right down, went due south over Chile and across the Antarctic, mm-hmm. and circled the South Pole several times.
Could you see the base?
Yes, mm-hmm. we had beautiful day and mm-hmm. perfect visibility. We could see all the mountain ranges in the Antarctic, mm-hmm. which was just a beautiful sight.
You flew right down the Transantarctic going to Christchurch.
Right.
Yes.
And we talked to the people based at the Antarctic Station. We talked to them and on the radio. And one of the interesting things is that Bert Balkan, who was one of our passengers, I'd asked to go along on the flight, we put him in the left seat and had him circle the South Pole. And he had flown Bert over the North Pole and the South Pole.
He didn't fly him over the North Pole, that was Floyd Bennett.
Well, that's right.
That's right. But he did the South Pole.
That's right. That's right, I'm sorry. I knew that. But
so he circled the South Pole as he'd done,
he had flown over the North Pole.
Oh, yes.
He had flown over the North Pole. So anyway.
Many times, yeah. He was based in Greenland, and
So anyway, we put him up in the left seat and let him circle the South Pole, which he was very pleased with, and we were very pleased.
That was neat. Now, did he get to make the approach to the pole, and or did he?
No,
gave it to him after you made one of the circles.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah. And. So, one of the interesting things is that we circled the pole maybe four times as I recall. And the question then is, what direction do you go? Everything is north. So, we put the navigators to work then. And
take a sun shot. I'll tell you quick.
Right.
Just figure out how many degrees.
How many degrees?
Look at your watch.
Yeah. And then we went from there to Christchurch, New Zealand.
Tell me, you mentioned that you took the first inertial navigation system along.
Yes.
How'd it work?
It worked fine.
How'd it work at the pole?
Fine. No problem.
There wasn't any air where. It kind of went haywire at the pole?
No. The only problem.
But some of the later ones did, and they had problems with them.
The only problem that we had with the inertial navigation system, that when on our first leg of our flight, when we shut down at Honolulu, the power went off of the bus, and. We lost the inertial gyros of the inertial navigation system. And so then we had to, when we got ready to go, we realized we had to fire up the gyros, get the gyros rotating again before we could use the navigation system. So we real quick worked out a fix so that whenever the airplane shut down, we always left the inertial navigation system on from then on.
Aux power into it. And
we kept power onto it all the time so that we never had any problem with navigation from there on with the navigation system.
And that was the very first one.
Yeah. Litton navigation system.
Oh, the first. But they built the first inertial navigation system, did they not?
Yes.
Is Joe Portney involved?
Yeah.
Did you know Joe Portney?
No.
Yeah, he was their navigator guy that worked a lot.
The three fellows from Litton were Peter Mosquito and Dr. Bjerndahl and a Japanese fellow, Jim Fuku. I can't
remember
his last name.
Yeah.
But they were the three fellas from Litton. But no, the Litton system worked great.
Yes. Well, great. That was historic.
That was it, yeah.
Very historic. So you flew on to Christchurch.
Yes, right.
Did you get a good reception there?
Well, it was in the evening, early evening, and I don't think anybody knew we were coming, really.
Mm-hmm. To Christchurch? Did you go to Christchurch or
Auckland? We went into Christchurch.
Went to Christchurch.
But that isn't true.
Was the field long enough to be?
Because we did have a small reception there, including the, I think it was the commanding officer of the Antarctic.
Was that Jim Reedy at the time?
No, it wasn't Jim, because I knew Jim.
Jim Bakutis? Fred Bakutis?
I think that was the name.
Admiral Fred Bakutis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He met us there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were only there about 2 hours and took off for Honolulu.
Mm-hmm. Fred was a great flyer, World War II.
Was he?
Yes.
Was he?
Quite a record.
It's in the book, I think, about
yes.
him.
Mm-hmm. So Jim had left and turned it over to Fred then, and that's about right, yeah, 64, 65.
Mm-hmm.
Jim flew his flights from South Africa across with Lowell Thomas.
Yeah, that's right.
In 63 and then another in 64, both of them with Lowell.
Right.
So I bet Lowell was disappointed not making the flight.
Yeah, he was very disappointed.
But his son came along.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that his son handled some special communications back home.
Yeah, we had this single sideband set up.
Yes.
That worked perfectly. Just we had voice communication through Collins radio.
Mm-hmm.
Their headquarters in Cedar Rapids, and broadcast to them. And they would put us into the telephone system, and we could talk to anybody we wanted to, just as if you're making a telephone call at home. In fact, I talked to my wife in California from South Pole,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was great.
Yes.
And,
was this one of the first single sidebands? I don't know when they came along.
Yes, it was.
So you did some pioneering work on communications on this flight
right.
then, too.
Yeah. And Collins were great. Oh, and Collins had loaned us an operator. I think his name was John DeMuth. And he did yeoman service for us. He was really, really great.
Yeah, it wasn't long after that. 66, we had single sideband on all of our aircraft. Didn't take long.
Right.
Didn't take long.
We had, in 66, we did the Jet Commander flight around the world, which we took Arthur Godfrey. But we had single sideband on that.
Yes.
And which worked great.
Yes. So, you flew into Honolulu, and that did the around the world.
Yeah, that did the around the world, and that's where we completed our flight, and then
back to Burbank.
And just ferried back to Burbank.
Publicity there? Was there a lot of publicity? News?
Yes.
News organizations?
One of the things I started to say about trying to raise the money for the flight and to get the publicity for the flight in the beginning, we had an attorney, my attorney actually, in Los Angeles, was one of the few men I've ever known who had graduated from both Harvard and Yale. His name was Dave Saunders, really a great guy. And Dave set up a corporation for us called Geo Atmos Explorations, Harrison and I.
Geo Atlas?
Geo Atmos.
Like atmosphere?
Mm-hmm.
ATMOS. Corp. And that was to fund the...
That was to take care of the financing for
the money
flight.
Coming in?
Yes.
They took care of publicity
and
as well?
Liabilities and that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing. And that worked quite well. But in trying to think of getting publicity, Dave Saunders, the attorney, said, well, the next time you're in New York, go up to go to the New York Times and ask for Bunny Loeb at the New York Times, and he said he will probably help you. So my next trip to New York, I went up to the 44th floor of the New York Times building, not knowing what to expect. And I asked the receptionist if I could speak to Bunny Loeb. And she disappeared for a while in a few minutes. And a few minutes later, I heard this real voice, loud voice say, said, show him in. No one has called me Bunny Loeb in 30 years. And he's I believe he was the publisher of the New York Times. And so he was great. He assigned a couple of fellas to us, mm-hmm. a couple of reporters to us, and we got good publicity.
You took the reporters along?
No.
No, but they handled the
publicity. They handled all the publicity, but they were great.
You know, this started with the New York Times. Polar Times came out of the New York Times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they helped set it up. The original Sulzberger, and now the Sulzberger Jr., he's our contact, and we can use any of their stories, reprint them without permission. It's
a blanket. No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. They're really great.
Oh, they're super.
So, anyway, that was...
So, did you get any post-flight festivities or honors or awards? Or?
Oh, yeah, we got a lot. We got a lot of publicity. A lot of aviation magazines carried it,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of newspaper publicity. I've got files,
mm-hmm.
files and files and files.
And did you do a scientific report?
Just that one.
Yes. So you did a scientific report of the Rockwell Polar Flight.
Yes, right.
And you did a brief synopsis on all of the work that was done.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay. We'll make this part of your jacket.
Okay.
Dr. Korf, did he coordinate putting this together?
Yes.
I figured he did.
Yes.
So he was the coordinator for putting the flight down, or all the work from the flight down in print.
Yes. I need to make one correction, I think. As I, thinking back on it, Dr. Serge Korf was a professor at, I think, New York University. I said Columbia, but I think it was New York University.
Doesn't matter much, but we'll find out. He was heavy in the Explorers Club.
He was very active in cosmic radiation. He had done cosmic radiation experiments all over the world.
The cosmic ray guys got the International Geophysical Year started. And the father of that was James Van Allen.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Father of IGY and all of the work that went on. He's a cosmic ray guy. Of course, the Van Allen radiation belt.
Yes, right. Right.
I can tell you a story, but after we're done with this. I'm sure he must, Dr. Korf must have coordinated this with NSF then, so you linked into their research.
Yes, right.
Yes. So, when the flight was over, you were still chief pilot with TWA.
Yes.
And you went back to work and retired a couple years later.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'm trying to think what the year is, 65.
Well, this was 65, November 65.
Yeah, 65. I'm trying to think about... shortly after that, I went back on the line as a line captain.
Mm-hmm.
I won wanted to fly the 707s and get some jet time, much jet time as I could before I retired, and did that for about a year, mm-hmm. and then retired.
I see. So you retired about late 66, early 67.
Right. Yeah, and then I retired in 67.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after that?
Well, after that, I started with Bill Pereira, the architect, who is quite famous in his own right, wanted me to try and start a commuter airline in the Los Angeles Basin.
You were mentioning that you're going to start a commuter airline.
Commuter airline. Bill Pereira had an idea of starting a commuter airline in the Los Angeles Basin. And I was recommended to him by Bill Lear. And I went down at a meeting with Lear, with Pereira, and I liked his ideas, and he asked me to see if I could start a commuter airline for mm-hmm. him. So I was still with TWA at that time, come to think of it, because I took a leave of absence from TWA, and he had already purchased three
One of the things you forgot to mention about the polar flight
was that as I recall, we leased the 707 from Bob Prescott and paid him $180,000 for 8 days. That's the way I recall it. And so at the end of the flight, when he got everything cleaned up, I had $6,000 left, so I sent a check to Colonel Rockwell for $6,000. And I got almost immediate response back from him that said, no one has ever returned money to us before, and we're not sure how to get it into the corporation.
Yeah, don't know how to return it.
Yeah, don't know how to return it.
Yeah, that's funny. So, anyway, you got your first Twin Otters for this corporate airline that you're thinking of starting. What was the name of it?
We called that Aero Commuter.
Aero Commuter.
Bill's name was Aero Commuter. And we started in the Los Angeles Basin, basically between Santa Ana and Los Angeles, and Ontario and Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so successful that we immediately started buying more airplanes. And
more Twin Otters.
More Twin Otters. And the airline was quite successful. And after a short period of time, Pereira was forced to sell the airline because of the fact that he was the main constructor of LA Airport and was very active in the running of the airport, and he was getting quite a bit of static about his participation in both running the airline and the airport.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah. And so we looked around and found a customer for the airline, which was Arnold Smith in San Diego, who was known in those days as Mr. San Diego. He is a multi-millionaire, basically in real estate and the canning industry. He owned the largest tuna fishing fleet in the world, and the canning company. And
he was hooked to the Portuguese families there in San Diego.
Oh, really?
Tuna fleet. They were all Portuguese.
Huh.
Yep. Wife or something, I think wife maybe.
He was really a nice mm-hmm. guy, and we used to go down, and the captain would invite us down to come down to eat at the, when the tuna fleet was in, you know, eat in the tuna clippers. Boy, they really ate on those days.
Mm-hmm.
Great days.
I thought you wanted off.
No, I didn't realize I was on.
Oh, yes, you were on. You were on.
Okay. Well, anyway, Arnold Smith took it over, and he had the idea of controlling all the traffic. Let me go back a minute. He had been interested in purchase. He had purchased several taxi companies in California,
mm-hmm.
and owned quite a few of the companies in California. And he's interested in transportation. And he had the idea of controlling the air traffic in the California corridor. And so one of my first instructions from him was to purchase any of the commuter airlines that were existing. And which we did. We purchased the five remaining other commuter airlines besides our own. We changed the name to Golden West. And it began to expand.
So you were the first president of Golden West?
Yes. And we had, we finally wound up operating 300 flights a day in the Los Angeles Basin for a period of about 8 years.
Did you fly too?
No.
You flew the you got some time in the Twin Otter, though.
Mm-hmm.
You got some time in the Twin Otter, though.
Yeah, right, yeah. A lot. But I hired a guy by the name of Bob Donnell, who I'd known for several years, to run it. And chief pilot of it, and he did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you were with Golden West until when?
Probably about 74.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do after that?
Well, Arnold was one of the big contributors to the Nixon campaign, Nixon fund, Nixon supporters, I should say. And when they got rid of Nixon, and you remember that story of the,
mm-hmm.
the Democrats went after Nixon, and as soon as they got Nixon, they went after Arnold, and just ruined his business, and forced him out of business, and so we had to give up. In the meantime, we had to give up Golden West.
How come? Did they get you on something, some law, or passed a law?
Yeah, well, I don't know the whole story on, they accused him of all types of fraud, you know, and they never gave him a chance to, a time to recuperate on any of his investments.
Mm-hmm.
And they just shut him down overnight, mm-hmm. practically.
Did someone, were you there then, or had you already retired?
I was still president of Golden West.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did the airline get absorbed by some other organization?
It did, but they weren't very successful, and they just basically took all the profit out of it and
sold off the assets.
Sold off the assets, and just kind of ruined it.
That's a shame. So, since then?
So, trying to think the circumstances that... I had, with Golden West, I had made annual trips to London to meet with the insurance companies,
mm-hmm.
and keep reducing our insurance costs, and became acquainted with some of the commuter airlines over there, and through that I met Sir Philip Foreman, who was the managing director of Short Brothers. They were at that time, they were the oldest manufacturer of aircraft in the world, having built airplanes for the Wright brothers in 1906, and they were the largest employer in Northern Ireland. They were based in Belfast. It's an English company, but based in Belfast. So. We got well acquainted with Sir Philip, and he asked me to take over and be president of Short Brothers USA, which I did. And just at that time, they were in the manufacture of a 30-passenger commuter airline, of which there were none at the time. And shortly thereafter, we were able to get the FAA to approve 30-passenger commuter-type airplanes. And were quite successful in their sale.
What was the designator of the 30-passenger one you manufactured?
The airplane was the Shorts 330. And later the Shorts 360. And in the time that I was there, we sold 150 of them. Generally to United States markets. Some three in Europe, but not very many. And I was there until I retired at 70, at the age of 70.
Did you move to Reno then?
And then shortly thereafter we moved to Reno, yeah.
And so you've lived in Reno for 12 years?
We moved here 12 years, yeah.
Okay, you're gonna add a comment on the flexible tanks.
About the flexible tanks. When we got to Honolulu, none of us had really had any experience with those. That was the first flight was going to Honolulu with them. So when we fueled up in Honolulu, got ready for takeoff, the flight engineer, Jim Jones, and I went aft, clear aft, right behind those big fuel cells, and to see what would occur. And as the flight accelerated and got up to speed, that fuel just came back and surged back there.
Had no baffles.
Huh?
Had no baffles.
It had baffles in it, but they weren't, didn't seem to me they were adequate. But boy, that they surged right back against those straps that were holding it. And I thought, sure, they're gonna go. And scared the hell out of me. But they held. And they held all the rest of the way around the world. But
yeah.
They really surged when they accelerated.
I've used them since, the flex tanks. They're kind of a bladder that's somewhat flat, but it's pretty heavy. It's about that thick.
Yeah, they're thick.
And there's baffles in them.
Yes, right.
So I never noticed much of a surge. They had some in
they have big, heavy straps on them.
Yeah. We also had a heavy tank, a big... I forgot how many gallons. Fill a whole fuselage of a Herc almost. You couldn't even fill it full and get off a lot of times. Hmm. Especially if you took off on skis. Skis took a lot of drag. Well, I think we're done.
Okay.